She has provided a great segue to our next topic, where we're going to drill down some more on bridging the gap on public and producer views on animal welfare. Our third Jeff of the conference is Jeff Spooner. Bridging the gap on animal welfare views by traveling the countryside and sitting in many a farm office, better known as the kitchen, he's conducted over 100 interviews, that's a lot of coffee and a lot of cookies, to identify overlapping views to advance a meaningful dialogue regarding farm animal care. Can diverse views come together? Over to you, Jeff. Where are you? There you are. Please welcome Jeff Spooner.
Flip a lot of pages here, so I want to just get this out of the way. Thanks. Okay. That may or may not work. Hi, good morning. Just a second here. And good late evening to the rest of you from Vancouver. So as Susan said, I'm a social science researcher. And I've spent, I guess, most of my on-again, off-again academic life studying disputes over ethical issues. About 10 years ago, my interest began to shift in the direction of farm animal welfare. And so in 2007, I was thrilled to join Professor David Fraser and the co-author of this talk today, Dr. Kathy Shoupley, both of the animal welfare program at UBC. Thrilled to join them in a national research project funded by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council. My intent today is really to just talk a little bit about this project, what and why we decided to conduct that. We'll talk a bit about how we went about it. I'll give you a few of our findings and talk a bit about how some of those findings relate to one another, and then leave you with a couple of recommendations that we've made as a result of that. Well, debates over the welfare and the proper care of food animals, as if I have to tell you, are not new. What is new in recent years, and certainly in the years here leading up to our project, has been the onslaught of governmental and intergovernmental and corporate policies outlining suitable care and handling practices for food animals. In other words, animal welfare programs, such as, for example, these here, specifying how food animals ought to be raised, right? Well, animal welfare is a term that can represent a wide range of views about how food animals ought to be raised. Anthropologically, as a lot of people have pointed out, perspectives on how we ought to treat animals tend to reflect historically deep-seated worldviews and cultural values, and I would say some social psychological influences as well. You heard a bit about this yesterday, I'll just briefly touch on it. Based on those observations, David Fraser, our own Dan Weary, Ed Pager, Barry Milligan, among others, have proposed that most of us tend to define animal welfare in accord with one of three orientations, reference to animals leading natural lives, that animals should feel well, and that animals should function well. So given these different orientations and values at work, it's not surprising that animal welfare policies often translate into differing care and handling practices, right? And by extension, once they are in place, frequently generate confusion and dissatisfaction. All right, but if values are inclined to create divisions, can they not also be used to establish agreements as well? In other words, does it not make sense to advance welfare care and handling practices that attempt to reflect a maximum number of shared values, if possible? Well, this is certainly the thinking that policymakers in the EU have adopted over the last few decades. Since 1998, there have been numerous studies conducted to assess consumer views and concerns about animal welfare in Europe. And some of the better known efforts include the 2005-2006 Eurobarometer surveys. These were surveys that elicited opinions from over 53,000 participants in 29 countries. And, of course, there's the Welfare Equality Project, which ran from 2004 to 2009. These gathered views and welfare recommendations from non-producers and from producers and animal scientists. So these are studies that have involved massive numbers of people and institutions and money and time. And as a result, the EU has made I think, considerable strides in attaining collective viewpoints and identifying areas of shared thinking among their major stakeholders. Well, in stark contrast to the EU, however, and certainly at the outset of our work here in 2008, few, if any, systematic efforts have been made in Canada to explore Canadian values about what constitute good or satisfactory lives for food animals. And this is where the idea for, and I think subsequently increasing importance of our research comes in. So in order to take really some very preliminary steps in that direction, we simply wanted to know what some of these Canadian values might be, and more specifically, we wondered, one, are there animal welfare-related values shared by some food animal producers and non-producers in Canada? And if so, how might those shared values form or contribute to policies that could be supported by both groups? So this project I'm about to describe was very much an exploratory effort. Our intent was to learn about and to describe the nature and the range of some Canadian views on the issue of farm animal welfare. And to do that, we undertook a multiple study, multi-stakeholder, qualitative as opposed to survey or quantitative studies. We used mostly in-depth interviews. And between 2008 and 2010, we conducted, as Susan said, 108 interviews, 101 plus 7 follow-up interviews. We invited participants' perspectives from across 7 of the Canadian provinces. Our participants included 23 commercial beef producers, 20 commercial pig producers, and 24 non-producers. We also conducted interviews with 16 dairy producers, 18 producers and non-producers as well in other sectors, bison, goat, poultry, and animal transportation. That last data, by the way, I will not speak to in this talk, but it since has now been written up and is nearly ready for publication and submission, but I will come back to that just a little bit later. All right, so of the 67 interviews conducted with beef, pig, and non-producer participants, 53 were face-to-face, and that is no small feat in a country the size of Canada. So as you can tell, quite a few of our interviews took place on farms and in homes, as Susan said, scattered across the prairie provinces. The very lovely prairie provinces, I might add, with those omnipresent skies, but like this photo, often very flat and frequently quite sparsely populated, and for those of you that know, a bit tricky to drive at times in the dead of winter. Thankfully, however, one does find signs of civilization from time to time on the prairies, and we also found some very hospitable and very generous research participants as well. So I'm going to turn next to some of our findings, and I'll touch only on those which I think are especially notable here today, and I'll start with what our beef producers that we interviewed had to tell us. So we interviewed 23 producers directly involved in the rearing and handling of beef cattle in Western Canada. And even though beef ranching has not been the target of widespread public criticism over animal care, ranchers, of course, do engage in potentially controversial management practices, including branding, castration, and dehorning. So in terms of some of our findings, we discovered that ranchers did not care much for the term farm animal welfare. They felt it acquired a rather negative or a critical connotation. Most of our beef producers strongly emphasized natural living, however, and also gave examples of animal care preferences which supported biological functioning and effective state priorities. Most notably, I think, our producers talked about animal stress, which they categorized as being either unavoidable or avoidable in nature. Now, unavoidable stress referred to routine management practices, which most producers would be happy to do away with if they could, but at present simply saw no other alternatives. And these included branding and castration and dehorning, as well as vaccinating and forced weaning. And what makes this finding, I think, particularly interesting is that producers did not regard any of these practices as animal welfare issues. Why? Because they were effectively unavoidable. And this despite the fact that participants did not attempt to provide animals with any pain relief as a rule. Avoidable stressors, as you would imagine, on the other hand, this referred to issues that could be avoided, and so when they were not, constituted the closest thing to animal welfare issues as our ranchers described. And as displayed, these included poor handling facilities, rough handling, inappropriate shelters, overstocking animal pens, inadequate nutrition, health, and unskilled labor. The reference to transport there is a reference to the required offloading, resting, and reloading of animals near final destinations. And the reference to RECs, that's a term to refer to catastrophic welfare failures. These involve situations in which Animals would be left uncared for over extended periods, often due to producer hardship or illness. Having said that, our beef producers were not of all one mind on a number of care and handling practices. Some of these differences of opinion included appropriate levels of care at calving, appropriate ages for dehorning and castration, the suitability of winter calving, and how long, if at all, cattle should be finished on grain. Let's have a look at what our pig producers had to say. We interviewed 20 pig producers, mostly involved with intensive pig production. And over the last few decades, of course, public opposition to the intensive rearing of pigs has generated considerable criticism in Western nations and increasingly in Canada. In terms of some of our findings then, we discovered once again that animal welfare was not a term used by or favored by our pig producers. Most of our participants emphasized a more biological functioning view of animal welfare. In short, animal welfare meant caring for pigs in such a way that they produced large litters which maintained good health and sustained growth. And these goals almost always required that animals be reared indoors, where they could be individually cared for in terms of feeding and health, they could be protected from disease, suffering, predation, insects, weather, and they could be kept comfortable in terms of thermal regulation and dryness all year round. In addition, proper animal care included diligent daily attention to animal needs delivered by trained professional staff in stress-free ways, and these requirements were felt by most to be unable to be met by small traditional or once prototypical family farms. More specifically, according to most of our pig producers, proper care involved preserving the well-being of pregnant sows and seemingly their developing piglets in utero through the use of gestation stalls. And while some were certainly ambivalent about the use of stalls, almost all had reservations about the popular proposed alternative known as group housing. Proper care also meant preserving the safety of newborn piglets through the use of piglet-friendly farrowing crates, even if that caused some discomfort for the sow. It also included practices of piglet castration and tail docking, even if that caused some discomfort for those animals. And once again, on that note, similar to our beef participants, producers felt that anesthesia was not required for invasive procedures. Participants found that the administration could be technically challenging and marginally effective, for example, in the cases of castration. They felt it caused extra handling stress, and they also believed it was largely unnecessary, as the pain involved was felt to be acceptably minimal or short-term. Now, having said that, producers overseeing large operations in particular were quick to point out that the animals were never to be neglected or abused by handlers or left to suffer when seriously ill. Let's turn next to our non-producers. Well, in contrast, of course, to many beef and pig producers, at least some Canadian non-producers have been quite vocal in expressing their welfare-related views about contemporary food animal rearing and handling practices. So we conducted 24 interviews with participants from 6 provinces with a self-defined pre-existing interest in farm animal welfare. We invited them to spell out their definitions of animal welfare for us. Our non-producers, perhaps not surprisingly, were quite comfortable with the term animal welfare. Most emphasized strong support for natural living. And among other priorities, it was important that animals have the freedom to choose as much as possible where and when to move about and with whom to socialize or not, and that provisions be made to allow for or to support maternal offspring interactions. Now, effective state considerations are also of obvious concern to producers, to non-producers, and so over and beyond the ability to experience these positive, effective states associated with natural living, animals were to be spared fear, pain, and stress associated with routine management practices, with transport, and with slaughter. Attending to biological functioning, on the other hand, was rarely referred to, and when it was certainly not to trump natural living. So in this regard, animals were to be provided with modest or reasonably preventative health measures, including vaccinations. They were to be attended to promptly if obviously ill or injured, but not a lot more. Most were insistent, however, that animals be subjected to humane and respectful handling, and tied to this was a preference for small family farms, where they believed that positive human-animal interactions were more the norm than within modern production facilities or operations. Having said that, however, there were some who thought that more intensive operations could still provide animals with comfortable lives, provided that attempts were made to accommodate and incorporate free movement and natural elements. Finally, good welfare practices were also extended to themselves and to others as consumers in the form of responsible and informed purchasing. I should also add that there were a few differences of opinion as well among our non-producers, specifically in two areas. One, over the extent to which organic production was believed to ensure or to provide good welfare. And two, over the views on the suitable conduct of animal advocates and advocacy organizations in terms of strategies and aggressiveness. All right, so let's look now at a few of the relationships between these findings. First of all, there were clearly some areas of agreement or shared values, which I hope we can build on to encourage dialogue going forward. So some areas of outright agreement included support for humane animal handling, support for ensuring good biological function, especially among producers, the recognition that consumers have considerable potential to impact animal welfare, that most non-producers with an interest in farm animal well-being lack sufficient knowledge about contemporary production methods, and that producers are at least partially constrained by economic pressures. In terms of some more limited areas of agreement, we found that among non-producers and beef producers, an agreement on what we might call an ethic of care, kind of a traditional pastoral reciprocal relationship between animals and the producers. We also found support for the natural outdoor living as important for animal health and well-being. If we look at non-producers and pig producers, we found agreement on the fact that based on acreage limitations and harsh weather alone, extensive production cannot be a standard or a norm in Canada as things stand. Interestingly, there was also mutual objection to biased representations of animal production methods used by industry and some animal advocacy organizations. In other words, opposition here to misleading advertising. Not surprisingly, of course, there were areas of disagreement as well. And having said that, I hope that some of our findings here will at least aid in more conciliatory or collaborative exchanges in these areas. In general, non-producers clearly expressed greater concern about effective states, especially with regard to providing pain management for invasive practices. Among non-producers and pig producers in particular, there were obvious differences over the degree to which biological functioning should trump natural behavior and natural living. There was a notable difference on the moral front over the extent to which pigs, as animals that are reared and slaughtered for human use, ought to receive exceptional or more basic care as a result. And there were strong differences over the welfare-related capabilities of small traditional family farms versus large-scale specialized corporate facilities. I'll refer to something that I call specificity differences. It kind of extends my last point. It seemed that differing degrees of personal experiences with farming, with farm animals, or food animal production may have also influenced the way in which welfare concerns were framed or specified. In other words, non-producers with little or no interactive farming experiences, for example, tended to discuss contemporary confinement production in somewhat broad-based or philosophical terms. Whereas those with more exposure to animal production, producers perhaps, or non-producers raised on farms, were often more specific, more detailed, or more targeted with their comments or their concerns. For example, beef producers raised explicit concerns about welfare issues that most non-producers were seemingly unaware of. For instance, some beef producers were critical of animal welfare at animal auctions. Some were certainly concerned with animal care challenges associated with outdoor or extensive production, harsh weather, predation issues. And most were far more aware of these catastrophic welfare failures, these wrecks I referred to, often associated with producer illness or hardship. In terms of consistency, producer views, at least within sectors, were also more consistent than the views of non-producers. That suggests that farmering and specific enculturation programs like 4-H may have led to a relatively uniform set of values. I'm going to talk about two paradigm differences, two framework differences, which I think are kind of interesting and probably quite important. The first I'm just going to call herd versus individual animal focus. Right. Producers often talked about farm animals in terms of groups or large numbers, frequently referring to livestock, while non-producers made far more references to individual animals. Well, perhaps not surprisingly, we saw evidence to suggest that producers and non-producers also thought about farm animals in terms of groups or individuals when evaluating cases of inadequate or insufficient care. And I think if you look for this, you'll see plenty of examples beyond our work. For instance, you might note the way in which producers may comment on animal deaths during transport as representing small percentages of either flocks or herds, as opposed to non-producers who often regard such losses as representing large numbers of individual animals. You'll see this same herd versus individual focus in terms of the varying ways in which producers and non-producers react to undercover videos exposing improper care of some sort, whether on farms or elsewhere. The second paradigm difference or framework difference I conveniently have called proactive disease versus reactive injury focus, which is just a long way for academics to say there's something here and we're kind of working on it, so we'll just throw everything into a title. Both of our beef, but especially our pig producers, typically equated animal well-being with the absence of illness and injury and the presence of sustained growth, and they regarded the potential outbreaks of disease and significant threats both to their animals and to their operations. So, perhaps not surprisingly, diligent animal care among producers involved adopting a definite preventative rather than responsive approach to illness or injury. In turn, this justified actions such as, or at least in part, tail docking piglets, castrating and dehorning animals, restricting sow housing, and confining animals indoors behind disease barriers. All right, but non-producers, on the other hand, rarely express concern about disease outbreaks, likely, I presume, because they ultimately failed to link animal disease with suffering, and this is based on their otherwise very strong affective state concerns. Moreover, non-producers may have also envisioned illnesses as more like injuries or problems capable of being addressed on an individual or a need-be or a reactive basis. All right, so what? Well, if this is right, then this will likely make producer attempts to defend invasive acts such as tail docking, at least on the basis of proactive disease prevention, it'll probably make that a pretty tough sell when it comes to countering non-producer opposition, at least as things stand currently. So in other words, whereas producers might look upon some surgical procedures with pride or satisfaction in the context of what could have been but what won't be now, thanks to their interventions, non-producers might take a more immediate view and characterize some of those interventions as unnecessary, inappropriate, or perhaps even as acts of mutilation solely favoring producer interests. And again, I think we see pretty clear evidence of this proactive-reactive difference online. If you read the reactionary exchanges beneath the YouTube videos depicting these kinds of surgeries, you'll see this kind of exchange take place. All right, we've also made a few policy recommendations in accord with some of these shared values. The first suggestion is to increase the use of shared or agreeable terminology. In other words, to encourage non-producers to make more use of terms such as animal care, animal comfort, contentment over animal welfare, if or when possible, when conversing with producers. This should help to aid communication and to facilitate relationship building. This is certainly not to suggest that anyone abandon the term farm animal welfare, but simply that non-producers are likely to be agreeably content with the idea of enhanced care or enhanced comfort. Based on non-producer preferences for natural living, there is certainly scope for producers to incorporate elements of natural living into their production systems. Given that non-producers tend to largely talk about animal welfare, especially in moral terms, and that producers tend to act first and talk later, we strongly promote small-scale joint stakeholder pilot projects. In other words, collaborative pilot testing of actual small-scale alternative or progressive production methods to help establish working relationships, to generate new ideas and insights, and to help acknowledge limits. Number four, given that there clearly existed like-minded thinkers among commercial producers and non-producers, we recommend the facilitation of enhanced producer identification efforts, such as more extensive use of product tagging, including the use of scannable barcoding systems or icons here. We're talking about on products. The idea is, of course, to try to enable consumers to more readily learn about or to connect with producers with whom they share views on animal welfare. Number five, based on widespread opposition to and distrust of the motives behind intensive food animal production. We recommend that food animal producers attempt to gain more public trust by duplicating professions through developing and assessing and enforcing publicly transparent production standards. And number six, based on critical comments by participants about misleading advertising, we strongly encourage all parties to maintain integrity in education and marketing practices. So in terms of recapping then some of the more important findings, I think, for policymakers and others engaged parties, I'd probably point to these items. First, of course, there's our identification of the share and the differing values here among Canadian stakeholders. I would include those paradigmatic differences we talked about between producers and non-producers, well worth noting. Moreover, I think that our work challenges often blanket criticisms about commercial food animal production, which maintain, among other criticisms, that virtually all commercially raised farm animals are treated without meaningful consideration. That was certainly not what we heard. Having said that, I think we've also contributed evidence to challenge or correct perhaps some popular producer assumptions as well. For example, that city folks are a bit too idealistic about animal welfare to be taken entirely seriously. Yes, many were idealistic, but we saw clear evidence that idealism can also readily accommodate realism. Echoing Christo here, the fact that non-producers may not be well-versed in contemporary production methods does not mean that they are not willing to know or to learn more. Many were. And finally, I think producers may at least have to acknowledge that the non-producers we spoke with were quite happy to have them dial back some of their hypervigilant restrictive approaches to biological functioning. In wrapping this up, and as I mentioned earlier, these findings represent very much our earliest insights. In addition to what I've talked about today, we've since completed papers and we'll be publishing results on the interviews we did with dairy producers. We'll be publishing a paper on the overarching comparisons among all of these groups involved, and I'm writing up a paper now on stakeholder views about transportation and animal welfare. And if you happen to like this kind of thing, some of our future work involve production-related value assessments. This is where we're inviting producers to talk about their values or their priorities related to on-farm management and the production of food animal products in very broad terms. In other words, asking you to talk a little bit about some of the values other than farm animal welfare. And perhaps some of you here might be interested in being involved in something like that. And I'm also collaborating with other social science researchers internationally in formulating ways of proactively identifying and then helping to avoid in advance future cases of these producer wrecks or hardships that I touched on. And I would hope that everyone here would like to support that effort in one way or another. But I think that's certainly enough for today. I thank you for your time. I don't know how we're doing for questions, but if you have questions beyond what we can get to here today, I'm very happy to be contacted through UBC and any other place as well. Okay, thanks.
Now, are there some questions? Maybe time for one or two? We have one here.
Can you sort of try and explain that divergence in any way? Is that just... that's really quite interesting to me.
Yeah, that would lie a little past. I'm interested in that as well. We haven't actually surveyed enough people on this to give you good feedback, but the immunocastrations among all this whole range of castration issues in Europe, in the southern United States, and in Canada, lots of research right now going on. They're trying to drill down into this kind of thing. Qualitative research is exactly the kind of vehicle you need to get to those kinds of answers. In Europe, you're seeing increasing acceptance around immunocastration. We certainly know producers here anticipate that you would have next to no positive response to that here in Canada among Canadian consumers. But again, I haven't delved into that far enough yet to know, but that's a pressing issue. I appreciate the question. Yeah, I find it interesting as well. Yeah. Are you saying that when we're talking about animals and care and handling, you found something odd? I mean, you know, the whole idea of one of the things that this research does that, that Crystal alluded to and that we're looking at all the time are the various frameworks and the paradigms that we bring to these things. We're all quite confused in many ways, I think, around our thinking when it comes to these things. We compartmentalize in very unique ways, and we keep those there for very effective purposes. And occasionally those walls break down and things get reshuffled and blended. It's probably in the process of something like that. I find the meter castration discussion extremely interesting, as much by the producers as the consumers.
So, great presentation, Jeff. My question is actually for Crystal. I don't know if she's able to take a question or not, if she's still here. But Jeff Erton from BCSBCA, by the way. Hey, Crystal. I wondered, in your last slide, you mentioned, and I think it was a thread throughout your presentation, the importance of doing the right thing and then talking about it. And I wonder if you had any off-the-cuff thoughts about how NFACS programs are helping with that, providing some substance for the we're doing the right thing part of that that recommendation.
Sure. Am I on? Yeah. I think, well, we refer, in our public outreach efforts, we refer to the work that NFAC does all the time. And I think the value of the codes are, it's the baseline that everybody's agreed to. So what somebody in BC dairy thinks is the right thing is not different than somebody in PEI dairy. And the fact that it's a consensus approach, which, as Jackie said, takes longer, but it's the better way to go. It says this is what Canadian dairy, the dairy sector, for example, has agreed to as the baseline. So then we all have that as the encyclopedia that we then can take the sound bites out of to talk to the public about. It also serves as the communications piece to take to producers to talk about, to say, okay, here's the baseline we've all agreed on and some options for recommendations for, you know, how you can improve. So it's absolutely critical to the communications piece to have that as the starting ground. And when we talk to some of our colleagues in the U.S. that have very different standards, versions of what they think animal welfare means, as well as to some of our colleagues from the U.K. Many people were at the Tim Hortons Animal Welfare Symposium last week at the University of Guelph, and Dr. Sandra Edwards, who was brought there to speak about it, spoke about some of the challenges of consumer confusion, lack of trust in the whole system from farmers through to retailers, and she used the term horse gate as something that put a huge dent in trust, and the fact that they have regulations and labeling and all of the processes. At the end of the day, her concluding statement was they've actually lost consumer trust, producers aren't making any money, and they haven't actually improved animal welfare. So they went through all the processes, but at the end of the day, they haven't gained ground in some of those, I think, really important outcomes. So the positive news from across the pond would be in Canada, we have a very great opportunity. We've got the process, we've got the table to sit at for everybody, but we just need to turn the volume up on the messages to let people know what's happening.
Maybe I could just chirp in really quickly. Jeff, do you have a question for me actually there, buddy, or just for Crystal? I'm kidding you. So one thought that comes to mind, and Susan brought it to my attention, when we're talking about professionalizing or moving in the direction of professionalizing, we're not talking about something necessarily terribly profound. Embracing and endorsing, championing the codes, advancing the effort of the codes goes an awful long way towards enhancing that public transparency, embracing the kinds of social values that will in turn reward producers with social autonomy. It means you won't have to be scrutinized to the same degree as in the same case, we've seen developments through other professions historically. Medicine was terribly scrutinized. Many professions have been, over the years, as they become more transparent, of course, they've attained a lot more autonomy, and they've been left quite a bit more alone. And I think the NFAC codes can facilitate that tremendously.
Hi, Ryan Lee with the Canadian Cattlemen's Association. I'd just like to compliment you both on your talks. I think they really fit well together, and something I've seen living in Ottawa and working for who I do, I often get questions about farm production and this and that. And what Crystal said was really good. We have to be careful as a group that is immersed in this to not want to dump truck everything that we know about everything that we do, or even think that we're getting asked a question that we're not. Make sure we take the time to to understand what people are asking and where they're even going, because the factory farm question or anything like that, I've been time and again, you got to remember that we're shoulders deep in it, but the question might be very simple. So good messages. Thanks.
Thanks. It's a pleasure. Maybe I can just make a quick comment on that. There's a term that I didn't use today because of time restrictions, but a phenomenon that we've discovered in talking with consumers and members of the public, the term I use often is olive branch. And olive branch is something that comes in the form of a critical comment followed by a sense of, hey, you know, I don't entirely really understand that as well as I might, and I'm somewhat open to either knowing more or learning more. Oh, but I still don't think I like it. But in the midst of that kind of sandwich approach, critical, olive branch, critical, I think there's a lot of opportunity to pick up on that and to go forward. You'll hear that. Any more questions? Hi. Yeah.
Jansen from the University of Calgary. One of the things that I didn't hear any of you discuss was, anecdotally, when you go around to livestock producers, they're profoundly influenced, I think, by their grandchildren. And everybody says, well, we've always done it that way. That's how we're doing it. And one of the things that I've begun to notice is that, well, we don't do it that way anymore because my kids and my grandchildren don't like it. And I guess I wondered if in your interviews and in your survey, Crystal, if you've begun to notice that. So I always sort of think to myself, society won't necessarily just be influenced by the Huffington Post. It will also be, especially for gray hairs like me, the grandkids. Oh, Grandpa, how come do you still do it that way?
Right.
That hurts.
No, I think that's terrific. I really think that's terrific because we picked up on that fairly early as well, and so we would invite entire families to join us in these conversations that by no means were they just producers alone. And we would often invite the younger members to comment. We often talk to younger producers about farm animal welfare approaches or techniques or considerations that they have incorporated since taking over the farms, for instance, and would have the father and the children, for instance, talking about that. I couldn't agree more. That's a very important part of this process, as I say, and we invited them to sit, participate, and be members at this table. Those are great dynamics. Nothing nicer for a qualitative researcher than to watch the people you're chatting with forget you were there and just start chatting among themselves. And this is actually something, too, I'm not going to keep us longer. I'm going to stop at this point because it's going to run out of time. Again, if anybody wants to follow up with any of this, either today or some other point in the future, we're very happy to, as well as the fact that we may be coming after you for interviews at some point. And I look forward to chatting and meeting with more of you in the future. Thanks, everybody.
I'm not going to block coffee break.